Good afternoon, everyone. It's always fun to come over here. The more I see you, the more friendly faces I see out there, not just at the holy days. For better or worse, when our first daughter was born in Southern California, we chose to have a midwife and a birthing clinic. Now, though we had childbirth classes, we didn't know what really labor was, to be distinguished from false labor. We can read about it in a book and take classes, but until you're there, you don't really know. So we were excited on a Friday night when my wife's labor began. I don't remember the hour. All I remember is that we were too excited to sleep that night. Who knows if it's going to be false labor? It's real labor is labor, right? So we're not getting much sleep that night. My wife is timing the contractions, and we're all excited. We were older parents who waited a long time for the birth of this child. And it went all through Saturday. My wife stayed home for church that day. Saturday night, no sleep because we're timing contractions. And by the time Sunday morning came, my wife was on the phone with the midwife and persuaded the midwife that it was time, and so the midwife said, come on in. So we went to the birthing clinic. But she got there for a couple hours, and the midwife has seen hundreds, if not thousands, of births. Said, I'm sorry, this is not real labor. It's not false labor, it's halfway in between. So back home we went. But by that night, the contractions were coming stronger, more firmly, and so the midwife said, all right, bring her in. So we were in at the birthing clinic. And when the water broke, then the contractions began in earnest. And as the contractions began in earnest, any woman who's gone through childbirth knows, without anesthetic, the pain begins to come. And my wife doesn't care for pain. I don't know if any woman does necessarily, but the way that she would survive when the contractions came is I would kneel by her bed, and I would hold her hand. She squeezed the daylights out of my hand, I remember that. And as the contractions come, I would begin to count slowly. One, two, three, and we kind of figured this out by trial and error, because maybe if I got to 15 and the contractions were at its peak and then they began to relax, I would count to 16, 17, 18. Well, you know, a child learns to count. And by this primitive part of her brain counting, she knew the pain wasn't going to last forever. It went on like that for hours. And I had no sleep for a couple of nights to speak of. So eventually, I realized this horrible feeling came over me. I don't think I can stay awake. Here's my daughter. Here's my wife in their greatest hour of need. I have to take a nap. Now, there's a cot off the room to the side that they told me was there. I don't think they should have told me, but it got to the point where I think I was falling asleep in the middle of it. So I told her I had to go. And, of course, this consternation look comes across her face because that's her only companion and guide at this most precipitous moment in our lives. But I remember thinking as I went over to the cot on the side of the room, if they die, they die. I can't even keep my eyes open. Now, another nurse came in and held her hand and did what I was doing, kept on counting. And so at midnight, after a couple of hours, I got a little knock on the little room and said, your wife's not dilating. Your midwife decided it's time to go to the hospital. So off to the hospital we went. And I kind of given up, Okay, no natural childbirth. We're going to the hospital. We're going to do the whole routine. And so while we're in the car, my wife's in the back seat. Here came another contraction. And I thought, this is betrayal. We've given up. Why are the contractions still coming? Of course, it was a momentary loss of mind because I accepted the idea we're going to be in the hospital. Now, the midwife was in the seat next to me. My wife was in the back. And it was midnight. We're going through Glendale, California. And as the light would be red in front of us, there's not a lot of traffic, so I looked this way and that way, seeing no cars, I head on through the red light. Did that for about 3 red lights, and once you know it, a police officer comes down the other side of the road, lights off. But I did spot him in the streetlights. The midwife saw him also, and she said, Linda in the backseat, she said, Linda, if the police officer stops us, I want you to yell out loud, it's coming! Well, we made it fine. The officer didn't see us, and off we went to the hospital. We had pre-registered, so we were ready to go. And as my wife was being wheeled down the hall, I and the midwife were following, here came a noise out of the hospital room. And it didn't take a genius to figure out she wasn't speaking English and she was in great pain. Spanish was her native language and she was calling out to her mother. I don't speak Spanish, but I could tell that. And she was calling out to God and anybody else would listen to deliver her from that terrible moment in her life. Now, it's a little disconcerting, so watching, I think the midwife saw it in her eyes and she said, that's transition. Well, we knew from her childbirth class that transition meant that's the most painful time of childbirth. Well, it helped a little, but I didn't look forward to that part either. So we got into her room. They put a little monitor on the baby's head, a little box on the electronic box on the counter, and you could see the baby's heart rate with a number value next to it. It was a boop, 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 at about 150 beats a minute. You could see the number, which was normal for a child at that time. But then as the contraction would start, this big python would start squeezing my wife's abdomen. Of course, the child's being squeezed, putting a lot of pressure on the heart and the arteries. And you could see that little counter on the number on the counter go boop, 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 starting to slow down, come down to 100. Contraction release, back up to 150. Down to 80. Slowly back up to 50. One time down to 10. And then down to 2. 1, 0, and it stopped. There was another lady who was studying to be a nurse who was a friend of ours in the room, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and we had this uh-oh expression. Nobody ever expected this. The midwife jumps into action, goes over to the bed, and starts talking to the baby and moving my wife's head. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. Telling my wife to breathe in any oxygen. I want that baby to get oxygen. And then, boop, 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 it would start to climb back up towards 150. Well, you can imagine our hearts were going and our stomachs were going up and down as well, never having been through this. And it was obvious as this birth was going on, the baby was under a good deal of stress. So finally it was decided my wife was to have a spinal block. So we had to take a needle and insert it up the spine, and you have to be very still because a little mistake is going to potentially injure the spine and nobody wants that. Well, the midwife had been through this many times, and she got right in my wife's face and said, I want you to look at me. And she got right up to her and looked at my eyes because she knew she had to hold still, do this as if it's the most important thing in your life. Because she knew that contraction was coming, and she could tolerate no movement. Well, they made it through a big contraction, enough time to get the spinal block. Meantime, I'm praying all the time what's going on. Now, if I mess up with a technical word, you'll forgive me. I don't know all the words, but finally the doctor came in. It was about 3 or 4 or so in the morning. Chinese doctor named Dr. Wu, very capable fellow, but I didn't like his first sentence. We'll try to save the baby, he goes. English wasn't his first language. You see, the problem was our daughter was being born what they call sunny side up, and the face is coming out looking up. A baby naturally comes, supposed to be, sunny side down. Now, this fellow, we learned, had an old skill that doctors typically don't have these days. You've heard of the word forceps. Looks like big old salad spoons. And as the baby comes out, they gently turn the shoulder and the head so the baby comes out sunny side down. And when I perceived that, when my wife heard that, she shrieked. I could see it. She didn't shriek out loud, but I saw this horrible look on her face because, you see, in our church, in congregation, there had been another young couple, younger than we were, but at the same hospital, and they had used the forceps also, and a tragedy happened. Baby's neck somehow got injured, and the child was a quadriplegic. So, want to adjust something? So as it turns out, our daughter came out fine, a lot of anxious moments, but I remembered afterward, finding my way out of the hospital, going on the steps trying to go home and get some sleep, and I sat on the steps and a 41-year-old man cried. I felt vulnerable and fragile. I remember thinking, why would God make childbirth so cruel and difficult. All we want to do is bring a healthy child into this world. And I remember Rachel. Rachel dying in childbirth. That could be my wife. Because had she not been in the hospital and able to give her stronger hormones, her body, she would have eventually fatigued. They'd be gone unconscious, but those old contractions would have come fruitlessly trying to push that baby out. Now, each woman who's given birth has their own story. Each one is unique and memorable to them. But all of that work in childbirth, and that's just the beginning, all the work that comes after that prompts a question. And that is, if God were to come to you, like the genie in the bottle, and say, I'll grant you one prayer request for your child. One prayer request. Ask of me what you will, I'll give it to you. What would you ask? What would you ask for that child? Would you ask for health? We're going to take that one off the table, actually, because parents around the world all want a healthy child, don't they? So that goes without saying. But if you were able to ask God for one thing and He'd give it for sure, what would it be? Would it be intelligence? Maybe you're athletic. And you want to share that part of your life with the offspring. And you want a child that's athletic. Or if you're musically inclined and music's a big part of your life, would you be disappointed if that child didn't have any musical ability? How about beauty? Happens to some people, doesn't it? Some parents just want a beautiful child. I remember one mother years ago telling me that she wanted a child and she prayed for one thing, that it wouldn't have some feature that she had. She didn't care anything else, just don't let it have the same bad feature I have. Well, what I'm going to try to do is make the case today that a wise Christian parent would want the same thing for their child. They could pick one thing that our Heavenly Father wants for us, only on a spiritual level. So if you have a daughter or grandchildren, they're going to have children. What one thing would you pick? God has lots of availabilities for you. There's millions of sperm. They can choose any particular egg that comes along. So He has huge numbers of combinations. What would you pick? One couple that I knew impressed me. Of all the things that they asked God for, they wanted, other than a healthy child, a child to be teachable. And I was impressed with that because, you see, any parent knows if a child is not teachable, there's only one other way to learn, isn't there? And that's through hard experience. And no loving parent wants to see their child learn by hard experience. I've thought many times, if I could take the little data chip I have in my head, put it in my kid's brain and have all the experience I have, I would be happy. I wouldn't have to teach them anything. But it doesn't work that way, does it? Now, some of you may disagree with me. Teachability is not the most important thing. But you see, then the burden is on you to come up with something that is a higher, more important thing than the child. Some people might say, I'd want a repentant child. But before you can get to repentance, you have to be taught what to repent of. And if you're not teachable, you're never going to get over here to repentance. Now, the proverb says that a wise man, even though he's already wise, will increase in learning. He's teachable. But a proverb also says that you can give 100 lashes to the back of the fool, and it still is not going to sink in. Now, if we stop, or if any other human ever stops between now and the kingdom of God, whether in this resurrection that's coming or the next one, think about it. If they stop being teachable, the plan of God for that person stops. Teachability is a major focus for God. Now, if you're still with me, I need to find a biblical example that might illustrate this. For teachability, who would you pick? Lots of candidates. Moses? How about David, a man after his own heart? That would have to rank up there, wouldn't it? Now, you may choose differently than I do. But for the purposes of today, I found an individual whom God predicted the person's birth 25 years ahead of time. Not only did God predict his birth, but God actually caused this person to be born. And I think there's reason to believe that God picked the sperm and the egg that he did for one high characteristic, and that was teachability. Now, you may disagree with me today, but the person I picked is somebody not often talked about. It's the person whose name is Isaac. Because, you see, Abraham was 75 when God came to him and promised a son. Sarah, I'm 62, Sarah was 60. To me, it doesn't seem so old, but for a woman, that's very old to have a child, isn't it? But you see, the child didn't come on year one. Didn't come on year two. It's a tough time to wait when you don't know when the promise is going to come. And year after year after year goes by. And finally, Sarah is delivered of a child at age 90. Abraham and Sarah waited 25 years. Abraham is now 100. Now, if you're Isaac, you have some natural advantages. Do you think this child is a wanted child? An old couple? One thing they crave most, one thing they were promised, and 25 years in the waiting? You'd have to assume so. His name was Laughter. Can't you imagine this couple doting on this child, running about the camp, doing all sorts of antics? And can't you see people looking out of the corner of their eye and seeing this old man and woman with a child and kind of smiling or laughing inside, enjoying the whole scene? He had other advantages because, you see, his father was wealthy. The Bible makes clear that Abraham was wealthy. That doesn't hurt in a pinch, does it? And, to make matters more advantageous, his father just didn't worship the God of heaven. But the Bible says that his father was God's friend. Now, it wasn't Abraham's idea to be God's friend. It was God's idea that Abraham should be his friend. So this kid, this young man, this boy, appears to have won the lottery, doesn't he? He came into the world with every natural advantage. But we know the rest of the story, don't we? Because Isaac was asked to do something no other human being has ever been asked to do. Isaac was asked to willingly allow his father to tie him up, stick a knife in his throat, and Isaac was expected to feel the blood spurt out, spill on the ground, and hold still on top of that wood until he reached unconsciousness and had his body burned afterward. Now, of course, this wasn't Isaac's idea. It wasn't Abraham's idea. It certainly wouldn't be his mom, Sarah's idea. It was God's idea. As an old, old story, I recognize that. And it's found beginning in chapter 22 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. Now, whoever edited the book of Genesis put a verse at the very beginning of the story. And that's important that the individual did so, because he says in Genesis 22:1 that it was a test. It says, now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. Interestingly enough, it doesn't say that he tested Sarah. We'll get to that in a minute. But it was a test of Abraham. And it's important that the author put this in, because we know from later on in the Bible that sacrificing a child is morally repugnant, something the Bible absolutely and God absolutely forbids. But of course, Abraham doesn't know this at this point. In fact, one of the commentators pointed out something. You remember when God appeared to Abraham and said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to hide from Abraham what I'm going to do down here to Sodom and Gomorrah. So he turned around. God goes back and tells Abraham what he's going to do. Abraham spotted an opening. And he's going to bargain, or give some response to God. Will the judge of all the earth judge wrongly? Going to kill the righteous along with the evil in the city? So Abraham saw a little crack, and he talked into that crack, and he negotiated with God, and God listened. But in this case, when he told him to sacrifice your only son, we don't find any account of Abraham negotiating with God back. And the commentators say there must have been something in the way God said it or presented it that Abraham knew. There was no opportunity to talk God out of the proposition. So we pick up the shocking request in the second verse of Genesis 22. Then God said, now take your son, your only son. Well, he had another son, Ishmael, right? 13 years older. But God makes clear the which one? Whom you love. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. And as I mentioned before, we know that this is a morally repugnant thing, revealed later in the Bible. Now, one source seemed to come up with a very good idea as to why God would test Abraham in this way. Because, you see, in the land around him, the pagans would take their child and sacrifice it to their pagan god. And the idea seems to be, Abraham, are you willing to love me as much as the pagans love their God? We don't get an argument from Abraham. He just goes. Its account says that Abraham got up early. Some people know it specifically says Sarah did not come along. The implication being he didn't tell his wife. What would you do if you were in that circumstance? You think mom's going to let her little boy go have some horrible thing done to it after she's now 90, she's now probably 110. And so we come to Genesis, verse 6 of Genesis 22. He had gone for 3 days, walked with the boy, walked with some servants, and now they're at the base of Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is going to be a steep mountain. You can climb it. It's going to take a lot of huffing and puffing to get up to the top, but that's the place where Jerusalem is today. So verse 6. The servants were left down below. And it said, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father? And he said, here I am, son. Then Isaac said, look, the fire and the wood. Where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Now, I wasn't there, but as a father, I imagine that stuck a dagger right into the heart of Abraham, because the moment was coming. How was he going to explain this to his son? I'm sure that he had been rehearsing how to tell him for 3 days. What would Isaac's response be? Would he run away? You crazy old man? Would he cry? Would he protest? One can expect all this whole range of human emotions, can't one? Now, Abraham answered and said, my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went on together, trudging up and climbing this very, very high hill or steep mountain. Now, at this point, I believe something happened between Abraham and Isaac, between verses 8 and 9. It doesn't tell us what happened. But there's evidence of it when we read the very next verse. Verse 9. Then they came to the place that God had told them. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Now the reason I say something happened between verse 8 and verse 9 is because what we know of human beings. Some of the commentaries put Abraham, put Isaac as young as 13. Some put him around age, the highest 30. I'm going to pick the age 16 today. And I'm going to suggest that no self-respecting 16-year-old male, voice developing, muscles developing, testosterone levels rising, is going to let a 115-year-old man tie him up, slit his throat, and burn his body without a very persuasive reason to do so. You see, Isaac was raised with cattle. And as a small boy, no doubt Isaac saw dozens and hundreds of sheep being butchered, both for food and for sacrifice. He tied the sheep up, slit its throat. Isaac knew exactly when Abraham mentioned the words, what was to become. And it had to be a gruesome picture indeed. I grew up on a farm in Minnesota. And as a 4 or 5 year old boy, there was one event that stands out in my mind. We had a hay wagon, big flat hay wagon. As a 4 or 5 year old boy, I stood on top of the hay wagon. It was chicken butchering time. My grandparents didn't live on the farm, but it was a big project. I could tell because here they came out to the farm. My grandmother had her hair all wrapped up like a swami, kind of a dish towel. And my grandfather had a big steaming piping can full, a milk can full of hot water, presumably to plunge the chickens later and brush the feathers off them. I have no doubt that some of you in this room know exactly what you've done because you've done this. And I remember somebody took a chicken, laid it on the hay wagon, and my father had one of my mom's butcher knives, stretched that chicken's neck as far as I ever thought a chicken neck could be stretched, and began sawing across the chicken head. And I, as a boy, watched that chicken go rah, like that, and the eye flutter a bit. And as the knife got down in, cutting an artery or so on the neck, I remember blood spurting up in my father's face, and he just shrugged it off. I thought that was really strange. But finally, the knife, the head is off, and it's just laying there, eye kind of blinking at this little five-year-old boy. And, of course, the neck is wiggling like crazy, spurting out blood, and my father would take it and put it in a cement cylinder so it could bleed out, presumably. And the legs are still flopping up and down. And with all that motion, some of the cylinders would tip over, and the chicken would hop up and start running through this nervous reaction with what energy it had left in its body, running around crazy-like, chasing the dog who was scared to death of this headless creature running around after him. I didn't learn until later in life that's obviously where the running around with that chicken with the head cut off comes from, but I do remember as a little boy taking this all in. Now, the point is this. So did Isaac. It had to be a horrible proposition when Isaac learns that his father is going to, dear daddy is going to do that to me. Now, Christians have long perceived that the story of Abraham and Isaac is really a little play going on. That God is acting out a play with Abraham and Isaac that he's going to later do himself with his own son in Jesus Christ. Christians have long done that. Let me rehearse just a couple of items for you. Isaac was a long promised son, an only son. Jesus of Nazareth is represented in the Bible as the only son of the Father. On the trip going up Mount Moriah, the account is interesting because Abraham laid the wood on the shoulders of his son. And the New Testament is very clear that on the way to the crucifixion, the crossbeam had to lay on the Son of God's shoulders, and he had to carry it to his crucifixion. We know that Abraham had to be thinking for 3 days that in his mind his son was already dead, and he had to live with that fact. Jesus was dead 3 days and 3 nights in the tomb, and for the first time in the history of the universe, the Father saw his own son dead in Jesus Christ. And Abraham, of course, the central issue, had to be willing to sacrifice the son. Now, in Philippians, it tells us that, this is Philippians 2:7, I won't turn there, but Philippians 2:7 tells us that Jesus of Nazareth, before his human birth, knew exactly what he was going to be getting into. And the verse said that he thought it not robbery up in heaven with the Father, not robbery to be equal with God. That's a funky 400-year-old King James word, it means, well, the picture is kind of like, let's say, a woman is having her purse stolen. And she doesn't know, and she shrieks and hangs on to it. Maybe you've seen videos of this. And the thief is tugging on that purse, and she's hanging on for dear life. Well, that's the image that Christ did not do in heaven. He said he did not think it robbery to let go of the glory that he had with his Father. But he volunteered, he understood the plan, came down to be shorn of all the glory and take on the full body of a human being. Now here's a question for you. At some point in this little boy's life, I mean in Christ's birth, when did he know who he was? Some have suggested that he knew in little bits and pieces, kind of like somebody who has amnesia, and a little bit of a memory comes back, and then maybe a little more comes back. Maybe while he was being taught out of the scrolls, maybe while he's talking to his Father, and eventually the picture comes into being. We know this because at age 12, they found him in the temple when they presumed he was lost for 3 days, and he's a little surprised. Don't you know I must be about my Father's business? Now, they'd forgotten apparently the miraculous birth that he had, and he was just involved raising him and the other children. But he knew who he was, asking the doctors hard questions and giving answers that amazed them. But here's the further question. When did this young boy, on his way to adulthood, know what kind of death he was going to suffer? Because, you see, crucifixions were normal in the Roman Empire. In fact, I was watching the History Channel one time, and it talked about Judea, which is what the Romans called the province, in the time of Herod. And it suggested, it just stated, that at the time of Herod, it wasn't uncommon to have the Romans crucify up to 500 men in a single day. I thought, well, that's much higher than I would have imagined. But listen to the purpose. You see, the Romans weren't stupid. It's much easier to prevent a rebellion before it ever gets started. So what you do is you put these crucifixions along the highway, and especially where there's a crossroad, so that everybody that comes by and looks up at that agony that man is going through, the message is very clear. You mess with Mother Rome, this is what you can look forward to. As a boy, as a teenager, somewhere in this young man's life, it had to click. That was going to be me someday. You see, in order for Jesus to know what it was like for us to be fully human, he had to be fully human. And he had to know what it was like to anticipate and taste death. Death is fine if it just comes in an instant. But to look forward to it and prepare for it, Jesus himself had to go through the process. In fact, in the book of Hebrews, it says that Jesus tasted death. And I remember one elder talking about it some one time and said, ever bite your cheek? You taste the blood inside? Well, Jesus, in that sense, had to taste death exactly as we do. Now, we know this for sure because he told his disciples in Matthew 20:19 that he, meaning the Son of Man, is going to be delivered up to the Gentiles, that means the Romans, to be mocked and scourged with the whip and killed. So he knew the type of birth that sacrifice that he was going to have to make. I remember years ago in Southern California, one of the leading men at that time, some of you might remember the name of Dr. Herman Hay. And it was after the Passover season, he was thinking about these things, and he gave a sermon where he said, he had a dramatic style, and he was kind of dramatic. So I remember this phrase, he said, if you think that the Son and the Father have always agreed, you haven't been paying attention. And of course, what he was referring to was the night in which he was betrayed in the garden, where Jesus three times tried to back out of the crucifixion. You're very familiar with the story. He prayed, Father, with you all things are possible. Let this cup pass from me. Not once, on three separate occasions. In reality, the story is clear. He was begging his Father for a way out. Now, Luke records something interesting, that his prayer was so intense that it dropped off of his face, as if it were great drops of sweat. Now, this is a known medical condition called hematidrosis. And it comes on an individual when they suddenly experience extreme levels of stress. Leonardo da Vinci wrote about this because he saw soldiers going into battle experiencing these same things. Luke was a physician. And Luke 22:44, he notes it, that he was sweating this. It was interesting that Luke would be the one to notice, because Luke, you see, is interviewing people. Luke wasn't an eyewitness. So he's interviewing people, getting the story. And the eyewitnesses talked about the blood and the sweat coming down. Luke, the physician, would find that of interest. Medical doctor writes that down. And there God caused it to be preserved for us. Would Jesus have made it? Could he have failed? Interesting question. Because the text shows that the Father heard the pleas. And he sent an angel to minister to the Son. Why? If the Son was going to walk through it and make it fine on his own, you don't need to send him a helper. But Jesus was going wobbly. And he needed an aid. I say this because the text makes it clear. You don't have to send him an angel if he was going to be fine. The idea is he may not have made it. This is important for us to understand the enormity of the sacrifice that he went through. Now let's go back to Isaac. Isaac had to have a lot of these same experiences. Okay, Dad, I'll jump on the wood. I don't think so. 3 days, Abraham, as I said, has had to be rehearsing, how in the world am I going to tell my son the story? Again, what would Isaac's response be when he heard the story? The account doesn't tell us. But unless you think Abraham at 115 years old was going to take a rope and lasso this young man and drag him like in a rodeo, we can imagine that he had a discussion with his son, right? Now, if I were Abraham, I think I might have started at the beginning. Back in the country I used to live in, how I first came to know God, how God told him to get up out of that land, away from his support group, and go into the land filled with pagans, a strange land, may not have even spoken the language, and live there, and how he followed it, not exactly knowing what was going to happen. I think he would have told him about the promise that he had for a birth that took 25 years. And of course, Isaac would have known about his older brother Ishmael and all the family stories that came from the struggles the family had trying to work out the prophecy of God their own way. Isaac would have known those things. I think he would have told Isaac the story of his miraculous birth. And Isaac can look around and see his mom and dad were old. Nobody has children when they're that old. And I'm sure they told him over and over again the story of their birth. I have 2 daughters. To this day, when we tell them the story of their birth, they've heard it before, but they never get tired of it. It's about them, about a time when they weren't around. If those of you who old-timers may have read in Herbert Armstrong's autobiography, there's a fascinating story that goes along these lines, I think. He had 2 sons. One was a younger son. And he was sitting in a high chair at 6 months of age. Fell out of the high chair onto a hardwood floor right on his head. That can't be doing the brain any good. Well, later at age 2 and a half, by then he wasn't speaking. Mom had 3 other children. She knew when to have children speak. Normally, this one wasn't speaking. On top of that, he had pneumonia. Serious enough pneumonia that the mother and father were seriously concerned. And the account shows that the father and mother were kneeling down and praying for this young boy who has pneumonia. And the mother prayed silently that her husband would ask also, not just healing for the pneumonia, but that God would allow that young boy to be able to speak normally. And the author reports that he then had the idea, maybe I should ask God about my youngest son to speak. And they recount in the autobiography how the youngest son began to speak in complete sentences the next day. Now, when Herbert Armstrong died in 1986, the Los Angeles Times magazine came out with an interesting story. Long story, chronicling Herbert Armstrong's life. So that he came into radio during his infancy, and he rode the crest of this new technology as a radio preacher. In fact, the Radio Church of God, later Worldwide Church again, became the largest purchaser of private radio time in the history of radio. I wouldn't be here, and a lot of you wouldn't be here for that. Now, I mention this because his younger son later as an adult would give sermons and he would mention, I was there, how his father and his mother told him the story of how he couldn't speak. Ted, you couldn't speak when you were little. And he said, my father and mother told me over and over again. So in this young man's mind, now as an adult, now finds his, what the French call raison d'être, his reason for being a telecaster or a radio voice on the radio. And as I said, a lot of us are there because of those two men. However, the point is this. I can't imagine that Abraham wouldn't have done the same thing with Isaac over and over again about the promise of his birth. Now, there's a problem for Isaac. Because you see, Dad, what about the other promises? You told me that God, when you saw him, when you talked with him, said that I, Isaac, am going to have children and descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. And if you kill me, Dad, how's that ever going to happen? God didn't tell Abraham that was going to happen. So Abraham had to conclude that not only after he killed Isaac, but that God himself was going to raise Isaac from the dead. Now, we know that exactly from Hebrews 11:19, because it tells us exactly that is what Abraham concluded. The only way he's going to fulfill the rest of these promises is if God actually raises him up. Now, we who know the Bible think, well, that's no big deal, right? A couple places in the Old Testament, God raised people from the dead. Jesus was raised from the dead. It's in our culture. It wasn't in Isaac's culture. It wasn't in Abraham's culture. This is a brand new proposition. So how long a conversation did they have? Hour? 2 hours? Half a day? All day? It doesn't tell us. All we know is that the evidence is that Isaac climbed on the wood, let his father tie him up like you an animal. You don't want to get halfway through the sacrifice and have the animal run away. And let his father put his head back and bare his throat. Now, either Abraham was one of the most persuasive talkers in the history of man, or Isaac was an eminently teachable young man. I like to think that he was. I like to think that God chose the sperm and the egg with teachability in mind, because God knew this moment was coming, because it was going to portray the teachability of his own son to come a couple thousand years later. Now, I defined, for purposes of today, sermon, teachableness as a willingness to listen and to learn. Pretty simple. Now, you may say, well, that's all fine and good. But what does this have to do with us? Well, if having a teachable child in this physical life is an important value, why would we imagine us being teachable before God would be any less of a value to God? And so I'd like to close with some suggestions today on becoming more teachable. These are no particular importance. They're not in any order. They're just random. They're just thoughts of mine. First thought. In order to become more teachable, recognize something. How do you approach the Bible? At the end of the day, when you come up with ideas and I come up with ideas, and they're good to come up with ideas, it's good to come up with questions. But at the end of the day, realize one thing. God is in heaven. The Bible is above us. We look up to it. We do not look over it, and our intellect does not get to decide what it says. We look up to God. It's not the other way around. If you do that, even though we have all kinds of thoughts that are great to discuss, at the end of the day, when we're talking to God, realize that our idea will not change God. It will not change whatever God has placed in the Bible. Second point about becoming more teachable is actually a practical one. Realize that we all learn differently. I have two daughters. One of them gets very little to nothing out of a sermon, though she's been attending since she was born. In fact, she's bored out of her mind during a sermon. But you see, she's a visual learner. She has, as it were, a superhighway of nerves between her eye and the brain. She needs to read the text. I need to see it myself. She has to read the Bible to get out of it. That's just the way her nature is. Now, I have a second daughter who's the opposite. I see her in church. She's writing notes to her friends. She's drawing. For sure, she's not paying attention. And I ask her afterwards, trying to catch her on something. She's got the point. She even remembers the stories of the sermon. Why? She's an audio learner. She has a superhighway between the ear and the brain. Now, we have some in this room who have been trained as teachers. There are other teaching modes, but don't be discouraged if you don't get it one way or the other. Reading the Bible for me is tedious. It's work. I can do it, but I can be tired. I'm an audio learner. I can put on a CD, sermon CD, or download one from the internet, be dog tired physically, and still have a sharp, crisp mind to take in it because I'm an audio learner. You have to find what works for you. Third point, becoming more teachable. This seems obvious until someone actually says it out loud. I suppose you never think about it. But it's to be aware of the difference between a carnal mind and a converted mind during an argument. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the carnal mind goes away from an argument and says, under its breath, who does that so-and-so think he is? Right? At least you think it. The converted mind will think, maybe I'm wrong. What if the guy's got a point? Or half a point? You see, the converted mind can learn from anybody. It doesn't have to flip somebody off who disagrees with them. And finally, the fourth point, and I'll close with this one, on the point of becoming more teachable, is that you might consider an approach that to use in the midst of a trial. I have a lifelong friend, and he's gone through some doozies of trials. And he always astounds me because he'll say from time to time that in the middle of a trial, he prays that he would learn everything he possibly could from the trial. And he says, I don't want to waste the trial. And when he says that, I feel this small. I've never done that. In fact, I feel like a hypocrite even telling you. But the guy's so converted, and it's evident that he's teachable, that I thought it prudent to pass it on today. He says, I have to tell you that when I struggle with this, to get out of a trial, I squirm, I fight against it, and I lie awake at night trying to find my way out of this mess I've got myself into or I find myself into. But if we want to be teachable, and a teachability is an important value of God's in getting any human to the kingdom of God, then which approach do you think will take us farther in the plan of God?
Thank you.